afternoon. We now have 1:32 on the clock. As I just said to Debbie, the goal, as I put in the email, was to complete everything by the third, whatever it is, the third week in June. June 19th, correct, thank you. That's the one. So the challenge is that means we have 4 weeks, including this one, which means that we need to get moving.
So maybe we'll talk about themes instead of line by line. I don't know.
Debbie, it means that we're going to be on point. Let's get moving. We are up to Perek Yud, Pasuk Lamed, chapter 10, sentence 30. If you are using the Stone Tanakh, page 1861, thank you. Come on. It's been 2 years. We know where this is. Pasuk Lamed. Last time, which was before Shavuot, we initiated our conversation about the Constitution. I really started it two sessions ago. We talked about the Constitution which the Jews accept in Perek Yud in chapter 10. We talked about who it is who enters into this deal, and that was the focus last time. We talked about the Chatum and the Chatumim, the possible double scroll versus taking it as one scroll, the sealing of the scroll. But now we're up to the components of the pact itself. What exactly are the Jews agreeing to do within this constitution of theirs? And again, for those who just came in, we're on page 1861 in the Stone Tanakh. So this pact could be construed in different ways. I look at it as a 7-part agreement. And it begins for us, once again, in Pasuk Lamed in sentence 30. So I'm going to direct your attention there. That was actually the concluding thought from the previous section. The thoughts really switch in the middle of the verse. We said that the first half of the sentence could be read in two different ways. The dominant way to read the sentence was to say that these people are the nation are voluntarily agreeing to and entering an oath to support that which their brethren have signed. And that brings us to, again, Pasuk Lamed, sentence 30. Lo leches b'saraso Elokim asher nitzna biyad Moshe eved ha-Elokim. To follow the Torah of God as given through the hand of Moshe, servant of God. V'lishmor v'lasos es kol mitzvos Hashem Adoneinu u'mishpatav v'chukav. To guard, to practice all of the mitzvos of Hashem, our God, to guard, to practice His statutes and His laws. You could read that as an introduction to the pact as a whole, or you could read that as part one. I'm choosing to read it as part one. That's the opening statement, is we are going to follow the Torah of God. Good. Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31. Va'asher lo nitein b'noseinu le'amei ha'aretz. We are not going to give our daughters to the nations of the land. Ves b'noseihem lo nikach levoneinu. And we will not take their daughters for our sons. That's part 2. Part 3, sentence 32. Ve'amei ha'aretz ha'mevi'im es ha'makachos v'chol shever b'yom ha'shabbos l'nkor. All of the nations of the land, it sounds like they are not Jewish, who are bringing merchandise to purchase, and they're bringing food on Shabbos to sell. Lo nikach mehem b'shabbos u'v'yom kodesh. We're not buying from them on Shabbos, we're not buying from them on holidays. V'nitoshes ha'shana ha'shvi'is u'mashah kol yad. And a fourth point, we will release everything, land and debts, in the 7th year. So you have 4 points so far. General Torah and mitzvos, intermarriages, commerce on Shabbos and Yom Tov, and Shemitah, the sabbatical year. We are getting there. We actually read through those verses last time and paused there. And it's a good spot to pause, because there are questions that we need to ask here. What exactly did they decide to include within this pact? Which mitzvos make it in? Which mitzvahs do not make it in? How in the world, how are we supposed to really understand what's going on here? And particularly, why do you need a pact at all? Once your opening line says, we agreed we're going to follow the Torah and the mitzvahs, so why do you need to specify anything? That's it. We agreed we're going to follow the Torah and mitzvahs. End the chapter. Move on to chapter 11. What exactly is it that's happening here with the rest of the pact? So there are three schools of thought. The first school of thought says, you're right, you could have stopped with the opening part. However, there are certain areas where the Jews are having trouble adhering to their mitzvot, and so they're going to specify those areas as a way to say, we're now ready to work on these. We're gonna do something about this. If you skip source number one, because it doesn't really belong there, and instead you go to source number two, to the Ralbag. Ralbag says this. Zachru k'tas pratei ha-mitzvos asher nechshalu bahem. They mentioned the specifics of particular mitzvos which were difficult for them. Kamo hitchatein baguyim, such as intermarrying. Vasos mekach umemkar b'shabbos, and as far as commerce on Shabbos, aval pisheni suro elami divrei sofrim, granted that's only rabbinic as a prohibition, as we talked about last time. They mentioned it anyway. Lefishu mevila v'rali sir Torah kamo aksiva shimalacha. They mentioned that too because it leads to violation of biblical law, such as by recording the transactions. So Ralbag's position is that the mitzvahs that are on this list make it onto the list because they are points of difficulty for the Jews of that time. Clear? Got it?
There are also things about living in a Gentile community, keeping you from gravitating toward the Gentile community.
Where do they mention anything about not living among them?
Well, no, not gravitating toward.
All it says is...
Staying as a...
Where do you see that?
Well, the kind of law, things that they're emphasizing.
Oh, you mean the general, these are things which will... I see.
All of the people.
Right.
So,
I think some of them, yeah, you can say that for maybe not doing business on Shabbos with these merchants, but then you would ban business with them all week long, not just on Saturday.
Then you're keeping Shabbos as a very Jewish religious thing. You're not going out into the community, mixing with Gentiles. What else are you going to be doing with them?
And the business about Shemitah is not...
That's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
These first two things seem to me very much like trying to keep the group intact.
All right. Could be. And that's going to lead a little bit towards what we're going to say next.
Shopping, you know, those are things you do in the outside community.
Marrying and shopping.
Well, yeah.
I'm not even going to touch that. But that's one take here, is these are points that are challenging for the Jews of that time, and therefore, what goes along with that, is that these are not really voluntary acceptances. These are things which were part of the covenant from day one. Other than, as Ralbag notes, you know, commerce on Shabbos as a rabbinic thing, but it's meant to protect biblical law. The challenge that he is going to have with this idea is that when we talk about the pact, we word it as a voluntary acceptance. Right? If you take a look at, which sentence did I want to grab here? I think what I was picking up on, and what the Talmud itself is going to pick up on, as we're going to see in source number three, is the general tenor of the opening of the chapter. Back in the beginning of chapter 10, where after describing in chapter 9 our challenges and so forth, we then say, and with all of this, we are making a pact and we are writing it and we are signing it, which sounds like there's something new here that we are accepting. It's not simply what God said at Sinai, now we're going to do it. So the Talmud asks that question and says, so how do you read this as simply fulfillment of that which they were already committed to anyway? So source number three offers us an answer. There's a debate in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud, which we're going to come back to. We're not done with this passage just with this. But right now, what we need to know is that there is a debate between Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Hanina, and Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Hanina's position is that the laws that are in this pact are already binding on them. Rabbi Eliezer's position is that they are accepting things that are new. So the Talmud asks in number 3, Ma mekayim Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Hanina, uv'chol zos? How does Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Hanina explain this whole language which sounds like it is optional, and with all of this we accept and we enter a pact and so on, which sounds voluntary? So the answer he gives is, Mikevan shekiblu aleihen b'sever panim yafos, because they accepted these mitzvos with a positive attitude. It's viewed as though they had accepted it voluntarily. The fact that they come in smiling and saying, this is what we want to do, that in itself is what makes the mitzvah something they are accepting as opposed to something that is imposed. That's the way Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Hanina is going to read our passage. It's just a voluntary recommitment to that which was already obligatory. That's one school of thought. Second school of thought is promoted by the Zakheim text that we read a couple of weeks ago, and that goes towards what Debbie was saying, which is that these are rules which are really meant for the maintenance of a religious society. The kind of society that you want is going to need these rules. Whether it is a religious set of rules, such as preserving Shabbat, or whether it is about the way you treat others and the laws of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, releasing the debts, or whether it's the way you relate to the temple, because we're going to see the whole second half of this pact is oriented around donations to the temple and giving proper tithes and all of that. It's all what you need for maintaining a society. And that's why he likes reading it as a constitution, because that's how he understands what a constitution is about. You are defining your basic principles and goals as a society, and you're setting up your rules, which are going to turn that into a reality. So that's a second way to look at the covenant. I didn't bring the Zakheim quote again, because we saw it a couple of weeks ago, but that's your second approach. And then there's a third approach, which frankly is the one that I find to be the dominant one in general in the literature, and it makes a lot of sense. And for this, we're going to track it through Malbim down the line as we go through the pact, because he promotes it, but he is far from the only one. And that is to say that parts 3 to 7 of the pact, meaning everything after the original, we accept the laws, and after the intermarriage point, everything subsequent to that is rabbinic. He doesn't say it regarding intermarriage. We did discuss the question of intermarriage outside of the seven nations, whether that's biblical or rabbinic. We talked about that a year ago. But he doesn't comment on that. But the position that he takes, like the position of Rabbi Eliezer in the Jerusalem Talmud, which we'll have to get to, he talks about some of this also, is that what we're really dealing with here is rabbinic legislation. This pact is, perhaps in certain ways, a landmark, as you find a body of rabbinic legislation being accepted by the community as their go-forward set of rules. Susan?
Is this type of passage from what you're saying one of the passages that sort of proves the oral Torah, like when people are saying, where did the oral Torah come from? And here he's talking about laws to Rabbanan. Is this sort of one of the proofs that there was an oral Torah?
Well, if I had to argue origin of the oral Torah, I would point to things back in the Chumash.
No.
Meaning, what this will demonstrate, and maybe this is what you mean, is it actually shows it live.
Yes, that's
you see, yes, this is an example in which you get to see it in action.
Yeah.
Yeah, from that standpoint, absolutely. Yeah. So, what we're seeing here in this pact are either reinforcement of biblical law and a willing reacceptance, recommitment to that biblical law, or a constitution to develop the rules you need to run a society, the society you want, or per Malbim, It is actually rabbinic law, which again is the dominant view as we go through the pact. We'll see. That's the dominant view of what it is that's actually happening here, both in religious scholarship on it and in critical readings as well. So your first part said, follow the Torah, follow its mitzvot. Your second part said, not to marry off our daughters and sons to non-Jews. This strengthens the idea that back in Ezra chapter 9 and 10 as well, there were Jewish women who were marrying non-Jewish men. The fact that Ezra didn't focus on it, I would go back to what we said back then, which is Ezra doesn't focus on it because he doesn't have jurisdiction. The Jewish women who are married to non-Jewish men are off living with their husbands in the nations they came from. There's nothing for him to say. Whereas Nehemiah here is setting up a rule for the parents, saying, we are going to put a stop to. It's not about separating the couples. It's about saying to the parents, don't let your sons do this, don't let your daughters do that, and therefore it's worded, regarding both genders. Ralph, you were going to say?
Who would have chosen these four elements here, or five elements? Would it be the people themselves? Would it be imposed upon them? Are there others that are not included?
It would be Nehemiah. It would be Nehemiah as the governor.
It's only Nehemiah.
Yeah, I mean the leaders all sign on with him. We had that list in the beginning of the chapter of who signs on. So they sign it with him. But don't kid yourself. This is Nehemiah. These are his fingerprints. We haven't found anybody within the nation who would try something of this scope.
Wouldn't they have been signing on for the Ten Commandments?
Why?
Because it's not here.
No, I understand that, but why would they? Why would they take the Ten Commandments?
That's the basis of Jewish law. And
is it? No, I'm asking in all seriousness. Meaning, how did Jews historically view that event at Sinai? Was that in fact viewed as the basis for all? Because there's an awful lot of Judaism that isn't there. I mean, the whole Mishkan, Beit HaMikdash, Karbanot, Tum and Tahara, purity and impurity, Kashrut, nothing. Now, I gave a class a few weeks ago on how the 613 are seen as stemming from them. Are the 10 representative of categories? There are ways that you can lead from the 10 to the 613. I don't dispute that. But I'm not so sure that they would have viewed it, and given the fact that it's not really played up, you know, after the Chumash, you don't play up that set anymore as somehow, you know, sacrosanct.
Our fixation.
I suspect so. And I think it probably comes to us from the outside. I suspect our fixation on it comes from the church. Because they stuck to them. I mean, I will say this. If you go back to the Talmud,
the church is fixed with ritual as well.
Yeah. If you go back to the Talmud, they talk about the fact that at one point in history, the Aseret HaDibrot, these Ten Commandments, were part of a daily prayer, and it was dropped because of minim, people who would attack the legitimacy of Torah, who would say, that's the only thing that's authentic. That's the only thing that matters. There was a movement to take it out of synagogue decoration, to make sure you wouldn't have what we have in many of our synagogues, which are some type of tablets on top of the Aron, because people took it as, this is what really matters, I'm a Ten Commandments Jew, right, and that's good enough for me. Now, frankly, for many people, I'd be happy if they were a Ten Commandments Jew. Don't get me wrong, there are important things in there. But historically, we've been very suspicious of the idea that those are special, and maybe the best example of it is the Maimonidean insistence that someone who doesn't stand for the Torah reading in general does not stand when you read the Torah reading about these Aseret HaDibrot, these Ten Commandments. You know, because you don't want people to say this is somehow unique. Those who do stand respond by saying that's true. But having a human being hear from God directly matters. I don't care if God's reading the phone book. So I'm going to stand when God is speaking to the speaking to humanity. And there's something to be said for that as well. Karen, and then back to Ralph.
The Ten Commandments, wouldn't it? So even if it isn't so important, isn't it a tremendous, like as you said, if everyone followed the Ten Commandments, so wouldn't that do something. I'm proud to think that it's first, like it's Jewish, because.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Don't get me wrong, please. I'm not trying to excise, you know, Exodus chapter 20. I believe in it. It's important. And yes, all of Judaism stems from God speaking to Moshe at Sinai and the entire nation hearing this. I'm not in any way minimizing that. But Ralph's question is, so why is it in Nehemiah's day they don't put that as their pact? And I think, you know, each view of what is in the pact will answer this differently. The view that it's rabbinic legislation has no questions. So, of course, it doesn't put in the ten. The ten aren't rabbinic legislation. The view that says we're trying to present the rules that will govern a society that will develop the way they want clearly feels that that there are rules they need to put in, that they do need there, and there are other rules that they don't. So it doesn't have to say, honor your parents in here. Doesn't need, that's not necessary. I happen to think it's an underpinning of society, but that's just me. And going back to the first approach, that these are biblical rules, keep in mind what Ralbach said. These are rules that they've been having trouble with. You know, maybe they don't feel like they have trouble with taking God's name in vain. We're good with that one. You know, we haven't lied under oath lately. On the other hand, the sabbatical year has been a problem. So that we're going to highlight. Plus, again, this issue of how central it would have been in their minds, I think, is an interesting question. I don't know. Okay, for those who came in, after the first minute, just to note, we have only 3 weeks left after this one, so I'm trying to stay focused. I'm glad to still take questions. Please, Elisheva, I'm going to take your question, but I just want to make sure that we realize that we're short on time in order to be able to complete it, and there's a lot to talk about. Yes, Elisheva.
Just a quick question, but is the volunteer nature of this also important? So in other words, the idea of, okay, all the other stuff, it's not mutual voluntary. That's already, we're doing it, we're committed to it. But this is some extra voluntary stuff, so we all kind of decide this, it's a rabbinic whatever, but is it voluntary? Is that maybe why these were chosen?
So again, it depends on how you read it, right? If you read these as biblical laws that we've just been having trouble with, it's not voluntary. It's simply, as the Rishalmi says, like we read in, which one was it? Number 3, that it wasn't an issue of being voluntary. It was an issue of showing that we embraced it. You know, it's a positive embrace of it, but not that it's voluntary. If you think of like, yeah, I don't see this really in the Jewish community much, but in the general society, the idea of a husband and wife who renew their vows, right? They're obligated anyway. But it's a statement that they make that they value, they treasure their relationship and their commitment to each other. You know, if I take the view, on the other hand, that it's something that we are enshrining because it's important for society, what they're really doing is saying we are volunteering to be part of a society together. And this is what we want to create. And if you take the view that it's rabbinic legislation, then it is. We are accepting what the rabbis are decreeing. You know, there's a whole other question to be asked, which we're not going to explore, but it's worth thinking about, which is, what do you mean voluntary acceptance? If rabbis have authority to make legislation, then what do you mean voluntary acceptance? It becomes the law. So the short answer to it is that the rabbis are not able to enact rules that the community is unable to commit to. If the community says, we can't deal with this, then it's not going to go anywhere, and it's actually invalid. There's more to say, but again, that's way beyond the scope of where we are with this. Okay, Ralph, you were going to ask one more question, then we're going to move on?
I'm confused by the word nitosh.
Okay, we'll get there. We're not there yet. I mean, I read it, but we're going to get there. We're going to go sentence by sentence here, because Debbie wants us to go line by line. So your opening part of the pact is to follow the Torah and its mitzvot. Then you talked about the intermarriage. Then in sentence 32, we get parts 3 and 4. First, not to buy merchandise on Shabbat from the Amei Haaretz, from the people of the land. Again, the presumption is not Jewish, who are coming to market it. So if you take a look at source number 4, Malbim is the one who views all of these rules as rabbinic. He says, "Kiblu al atzmam isur mekachu memkar shelo nizkar batera beferush." They accepted upon themselves this prohibition against commerce, which is not mentioned explicitly in the Chumash. Now, Nehemiah is not done talking about Shabbos. This is his only reference in the pact, but in chapter 13, he's going to have a lot more to say about Shabbat observance. He will have quite a bit to say. But this is the one that fits most cleanly into the vision that we're talking about rabbinic law. Right? This is the one that makes it most clear that we're dealing with rabbinic legislation, because everybody agrees that the prohibition against commerce on Shabbat is indeed rabbinic. So that's fairly easy. You could make an argument that there are aspects of it that are biblical. The Torah says that you shall work for 6 days and complete all of your labor. So in the event that you're still looking to buy things, then I guess you didn't finish all of your labor. But as a matter of straight, hard law, it's very clear that the prohibition against commerce that's being discussed here is indeed rabbinic legislation, and it provides the basis for what Malbim and others say, that this pact is rabbinic law in general. And then he gets the second half of the sentence. And the second half of the sentence is this business of Shemitah. So Ralph points out the word. Vinitosh et hashanah shvi'it umasha kol yad. So vinitosh is we will abandon.
Abandon.
Correct. When the Torah presents the mitzvah of Shemitah, it says, uvash shvi'it tishmetena unitashta. You shall release it and you shall abandon it. Looking here at the art scroll, their word is relinquish. I like abandon. I like abandon. I think it's a more accurate term.
Refrain?
Yeah. Is that what they say?
Yeah.
Refrain?
Refrain from cultivating.
Oh, refrain from cultivating. So they're throwing in words. Okay. Fine. Yeah.
So the English in this book here uses forego. But forego means not to do it.
Correct. I'm not going. No, I right. This is the funny thing about the wording in this sentence. Correct. This is the funny thing within this sentence. If I were to try to translate it word for word, I could read it as, "And we will forego the seventh year," as in we're skipping the seventh year. That's not what's meant, though. What is meant is to forego the land, to relinquish, abandon, refrain, whatever the cultivation of the land. Rebecca.
I think it's more than refraining from cultivating.
What do you mean?
Well, it's because you also relinquish your possession of it. So I think that's more limiting than abandon.
Right. Well, actually, no. That's exactly why I chose. You're right. I mean, that's why I chose the word abandon.
I'm saying that translation isn't as all-encompassing as abandon.
Ah. Got it. I think that's true. Meaning part of Shemitah is you have to allow everybody to come into your field and take whatever stuff is growing wildly. It's not just that we're not going to cultivate it, but we're actually going to make it available to everybody. The Medrash on it actually goes even further. The Mechilta in Parashas Mishpatim says that you technically, biblically, should be obligated to break down your fences actively at the start of the Shemitah year. However, the rabbi said, we're not going to force people to do that because the result is going to be that people will come into your field and destroy the plants themselves, the trees themselves. You need to have some sense of order here, and that's too much to expect. So, all right, just make sure that when people want to come in, they have access. That's what we say instead. So, I will give you two answers to that question. One of them is right. No, the answer is this. There are people in Israel today who observe Shemitah fully, meaning that they will not plant, that they will open up the field and so on. There are funds that are intended to help them. Karen Hashvi'is is one of them that are meant to support them in doing so. However, if you go back to the late 1880s, early 1890s, when you first started to see Jews in real numbers cultivating the land, and quite a few of them wanted to know, what are we doing about the sabbatical year? You found a suggestion for what today is colloquially termed heter mechira. And basically what heter mechira means, literally, is the leniency of sale. And what it means is you sell your land to somebody who is not Jewish for a period of a couple of years, which include the sabbatical year, and that doesn't permit work on the land. It's really important to understand what heter mechira permits and does not permit. It does not permit work on the land. What it permits are certain acts which are rabbinically prohibited, is what it permits. In other words, it only works for certain actions, and generally speaking, if I remember correctly, I taught about this, but it was during the last Shemitah year, so it's already about 4 years ago. If I remember correctly, the workers tend to be non-Jews. You don't have Jews going to work on the land at all. It's non-Jews who are doing the work. Now, this Heter Mechira, as it's called, was controversial back when it was first suggested, but it was viewed as the only way that the farmers were going to survive. Because of that, and because that was the way it was presented, it's come under fire at different times over the decades ever since. Also, it has come under fire in terms of tourists. Meaning, it's one thing to say, well, the farmer needs to be able to produce and to market his stuff, because otherwise he's gonna go broke. I'm a tourist wandering around the land for a week. I could get by without their cucumbers and tomatoes. So am I justified in relying on the Heter Mechira? So that's been subject to debate as well. Most controversially, the last two or three Shemitah cycles, North American Hashgachot have not allowed the use of Heter Mechira for produce marketed in North America. Meaning they said, we don't need those tomatoes and cucumbers. Therefore, realistically in terms of what shows up here, oranges and pomegranates. Therefore they told people not to use it.
When I was for Florida, for example, there was this bakery and had a Hashgacha. I thought they were open Friday, Saturday. People told me, and I said, well, how can you get a Hashgacha? Totally, they sell Friday night,
that's a completely different point. I feel very comfortable saying that.
It's not.
There are several reasons to distinguish between those two. It's a fun discussion also, but not for right now. But one of the elements that makes the Heter Mechira possible is exactly where we're going with this half of the sentence. If Malbim believes that we're talking about rabbinic law, then Shemitah is not rabbinic, Shemitah is biblical. So what are you talking about by saying that it's rabbinic? So take a look back in this Malbim in source number 4 that we stopped in the middle of. And this is where the Yerushalmi came into this picture also, the Jerusalem Talmud. Where in the middle of the line, Vinitosh, right, we shall abandon, relinquish, release. The La Fuke Mimanda Omar Shem Ein Yovel Ein Shmita Ve Ein Yovel Noheg Rak Bizman Shakol Yoshveha Aleha. He says this is as opposed to the view that if there is no Yovel, there is no Shmita. Meaning, that means he is rendering it as biblical. That's very interesting. Hang on. I thought Malbim was doing the opposite, but now I see he's not. That's very interesting. Now I'm confused. Okay, let me explain that side of the text and I'll show you what Malbim did that surprised me. There is a basic debate regarding Shemitah. When does Shemitah apply? We know that it begins when the Jews enter the land. That's when the clock starts ticking. However, it has to stop, or we think, well, I shouldn't say that. It might stop when the Jews are exiled from the land. And that's a basic debate. The debate in Hebrew is Kedusha Rishona, the initial sanctity. Was it Kidsha L'Shata V'Kidsha L'Atid Lavo? It was sanctified from that time onward into the future and it never leaves. And therefore Shemitah remains biblical down the line. Or Kidsha L'Shata, it was sanctified for that time, V'Lo Kidsha L'Atid Lavo, but it was not sanctified eternally. And the sanctity, in order for the sanctity to be restored, you're going to require what we call Kol Yoshveha Aleha. All of her residents live there. Meaning, all the Jews come back to Israel. What does all Jews come back to Israel mean? I'm glad you asked. It is subject to intense debate. Ranging from 600,000 Jews, because the census of the Jews in the wilderness, right, the military census counted 600,000, so therefore 600,000 is it. To a view that says that the majority of world Jewry have to live in Israel, a threshold we are roughly at this point, depending on whom you ask, or a third view, this was the view of Rav Soloveitchik, that it's when you have not only world Jewry living in Israel, but that you have representatives of each Shevet, of each tribe, living in its ancestral tribe. tribal land. Lots of luck. Right. And then there's a view that actually accepts that idea, but says that original division of the land was canceled anyway once we were exiled, and therefore it's not my standard anymore. It would have been the standard, but it's no longer the standard. But the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, debates exactly that point. That's their big question. Did the original sanctity last or not? And Rabbi Eliezer says the original sanctity did not last. And that's why they need to make a statement here in sentence 32, we're going to observe Shemitah rabbinically. Because it's not biblically binding on them. Because the Jews come back under Nehemiah, you don't have 600,000. Right? We know our censuses have been. They've been 5 digits, not 6 digits. Right? And you don't have representatives of each tribe in the land. You don't have all the things that you're looking for. So Rabbi Eliezer says this is proof that Shemitah is rabbinic at that point. Whereas Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, who we quoted in source number 3, disagrees. And he says the original sanctity remains, and this was biblical. Then why does it sound voluntary? Because they accepted it with a whole heart. That's the view of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, is that this is actually still biblical. So that's the debate of the Talmud Yerushalmi. And that's confusing me in the Malbim, because when I first read Malbim, I thought he was saying that it's actually rabbinic, but he's not. He's saying because they included this, right? Because they included this statement of abandoning the land, that is as opposed to the view that says that if there's no Yovel, no Jubilee year, because the Jews don't live in the land, and the Yovel, why Yovel is the standard doesn't matter for our purposes. What Yovel is doesn't matter for our purposes. But the statement is that they're rejecting the view that Shemitah wasn't binding. And they're saying, yes, it is binding on us, even biblically. So I think Malam actually takes it as biblical here. Ralph, you've been waiting very patiently for me to read. Yes.
How are we to interpret this? Are they going to do it or not do it?
They are going. No, it's very clear they are upholding Shemitah.
What?
It's very clear. They are going to practice Shemitah. The only debate is it biblical or rabbinic? That's the sole debate here. That's the line. The line is very clear. They're not saying we're going to abandon the seventh year practice.
So it all depends on how you interpret Netosh.
No. It has nothing to do with how you interpret the word Netosh. Everybody agrees that what is being said here is we are going to abandon the land in the seventh year and we are going to abandon all debts. The only debate is, did they include this here to say we're going to commit to the biblical law? Or did they include this here to say the biblical law is not binding but we're going to commit to it rabbinically? That's the sole debate. Everybody agrees, and everybody across the board, in commenting on the sentence, it's unusual to be able to say that, but it's true. Everybody across the board takes the sentence as we are committing to observe Shemitah. Yeah.
And the year that they're going to start counting from is the year that was pre-exilic.
No.
Okay.
No. If the count stops, then you have to restart the count.
And you restart the count
from when you start observing it again.
Now, at this point, or
yeah.
Ezra came back?
No, if they haven't been observing it until now, it starts now. Yeah. It's actually, there's a whole other debate, which you don't really need, but I'm going to mention it now because you asked for it. There's a whole other debate about how counting Shemitah works. Meaning, and now we will get into Yovel a little bit. Yovel is observed, the Jubilee year is observed every 50 years. So, I start from year 1, which is when the Jews enter the land, because that's meaning originally under Joshua. That's when Shemitah, Yovel begin. I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7th year is my Shemitah year. Go to 14, 21, 28, 35, 42, 49. The year 50 is your Yovel year, is your Jubilee year, correct? Now, when is your next Shemitah year? Counting from the beginning, when is your next sabbatical year? You have two ways. There are two answers, and neither of them is wrong. Either Yovel is year 0, it doesn't count, in which case you start year 1 the following year,
51.
And then you start and you do your cycle again, and then again, 49 will be Shemitah and 50 will be Yovel. Or you say no. There's no reason to put the Shemitah count on pause. Year 50 is also year 1 of my next count. And therefore, next Shemitah year is actually going to be year 56. And the result of that will be 84, 91, 98 will be a Shemitah year. 99 is a regular year. And then 100 is going to be your Yovel year. You're going to have a gap in between. And with each successive 50-year cycle, you're going to have another year gap in between, which creates big problems, because the Torah text talks about the mitzvah of Yovel and says, you're going to say, how am I supposed to survive, and I can't plant this year, and it may sound like they're consecutive. But according to this, they're not. So the reason why this is such a big headache, you haven't even heard the headache yet. The reason why this is such a big headache is because there are periods in Jewish history in which we observe Shemitah, but not Yovel. And so the question now is, so how does my Shemitah count? If you're right that Shemitah stops for the Yovel year, that Yovel year is a dead year in the cycle, and then you start your cycle afterwards, the first way that I gave for counting it, what do you do when there is no such thing as a Yovel year? So the Gemara in Erchin has a nice long discussion about this. It will confuse everybody. And we're not going to discuss it now, except to say that that's what you brought upon yourself by asking this question. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, the practice of Jews has been to take the second approach. Even though the second approach, which says that you just keep going 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, is a little bit illogical in terms of what it will do to the association between Shemitah and Yovel, that's what we do. It's just 7s down the line. The second fortunate piece is that when you do the math that works out, that the count from creation, even though Shemitah did not start with creation, but the standard count from creation works for year one to be year one of the cycle. Why do you care? Because if you ever want to know what year you're up to in the cycle, you take the traditional Jewish count from creation, 5, 7, 7, 8 this year, and you divide it by 7, and you get your answer. Probably halachically inaccurate, but it works. So what that means is that if you do your math now, right, so you know 57, you have a 56, that's your multiples, you have a remainder of 1, then you have a remainder of 3, and then 35, so that means we're now in the third year of the Shemitah cycle. That's what, that's how it works. I'm not going to ask if that was clear, because I don't want to know the answer. Yes.
During Yovel, you can't work the land, or you can.
So in a Yovel year, you don't work the land.
So you point out 2 years in a row.
Correct.
That's right.
But only if they are in a row.
But when they are,
that's what the Torah says in the beginning of Parshas Behar. The farmer says, what am I supposed to do? Right? And Hashem's answer is, V'asata tatvua l'shlosh hashanim. The land will produce enough for 3 years. Don't worry about it.
Oh, really?
That's the promise. Like any other nation that we promise. What do you mean? What? Well, you can. Sure you can. The only catch that you have is with Chadash until Pesach. No, you can eat in the third year. You have no problem. No problem whatsoever. You can eat anything that grows in the second year also. It's just nothing's going to grow. That's the only problem that you're going to have. Where is it coming from? Yeah, no, you can eat in Shemitah itself. You can eat whatever grows. We're fine with that. Yeah. Okay, so having said all of this, and now having to reread the Malbim to figure out what he's saying, the general trend is indeed to say that this is, as Rabbi Eliezer says, evidence that Shemitah is rabbinic in the Second Temple. Side note, because we haven't had enough, but because it's something that people always ask about, Prosbul. Right? Prosbul. There is a rule that says, and we mentioned it right here, that in the seventh year, you release all outstanding debts. Meaning, any money that is not yet claimable is still owed. Shemitah doesn't do anything to that. If Rosh Hashanah at the end of the Shemitah year is September 6th, and the debt is not claimable until October, that debt survives Shemitah. However, any debt that was owed beforehand, it was claimable beforehand, and the debtor hasn't paid it back, is supposed to be released. However, as recorded in the Gemara and the Mishnah, Hillel finds an existing loophole. Well, the existing loophole isn't the novelty, but he turns the loophole into an institution. The loophole says that a debt owed to an individual is annulled by Shemitah. However, a debt annulled to an institution, Beit Din for our purposes, a rabbinical court, is still claimable. The Beit Din is able to claim it. So Hillel comes along and says, we have a problem. There's a biblical prohibition against refusing to lend people money before Shemitah. The Torah explicitly states, you are not allowed to refrain from lending because Shemitah is coming. Hillel says, but people are violating that left and right because they're all afraid that their debts are not going to be repaid and they're refusing to lend. So he says, I know for sure that they're violating a biblical law. On the other hand, I have a way around it. If I take this loophole and institutionalize it, then people will continue to lend and they'll satisfy the biblical law. So what does he do? He says, here's a form, it's called the prosbul, which you can fill out, assigning your debt to a rabbinical court, as though the rabbinical court was actually going to claim it. The rabbinical court is never going to see it, doesn't even know that you've done it. You don't even file a paper with them. You just write their names down on the piece of paper and say, I have assigned it to them, and that's good enough. How in the world can you do this? You're ruining the law of Shemitah. So the answer to it is that, number one, Hillel says, well, I'm honoring the biblical law of making sure people lend. But number two, following what we've said here, in Hillel's day, Second Temple, Shemitah's rabbinic. Shemitah's only rabbinic in his day. So, therefore, it's vulnerable to him taking advantage of the loophole. The real question is, what if you take the view that Shemitah is biblical at that point? And then you get this very strange idea. The idea is, it's discussed between Tosfot and the Ramban, is that the enactment was created not to be used in Hillel's day, but they knew the temple was going to be destroyed, and it was meant to be active only once the temple would be destroyed. At that point, it would be useful. Talk about your Ayin Hara. Here is a rabbinic law that I'm going to create because I expect that the temple is going to be destroyed. But I won't tell you how many kids I have. It's a very remarkable idea. In any case, going back somewhere towards Nehemiah now. This is the fourth part, is to observe Shemitah. And we know that this has been an issue for them. Right, the issue of nullifying debts came up for us back in chapter 5. Right, when the people complained about the debts that were being held, and Nehemiah forced the release of the debts. And we said at the time from Ibn Ezra that it could be that was a Shemitah year. But even if you don't take Ibn Ezra's view that that was a Shemitah year, it just highlights for us the problems they had with people owing money. Okay, we're going to go through the rest of this chapter here, one way or another. So, Pasuk Lama Gimel, sentence 33. Ve'he'emadnu aleinu mitzvot. We established mitzvot upon ourselves. It sure sounds voluntary, doesn't it? We established mitzvot for ourselves. Latet aleinu shlishit ha-shekel bashana. To give one-third of a shekel every year. Very magnanimous. La'avodat beit Elokeinu, for the work of the house of our God. Lelechem hamarechet, for the bread, the show bread, lechem apanim, that's there every week. Uminchat hatamid, and the daily offering as well. This was flour and wine and oil. Ula'olat hatamid, and the daily korban olah, the daily lamb that they brought in the morning and in the evening. Hashabbatot, hachadashim, lamoadim, as well as for the korbanot of Shabbat, of Rosh Chodesh, of Yom Tov, of lachadashim, of lachataot, as well as for general communal offerings, as well as for the korban chatat, the communal sin offerings that had to be brought, such as on Rosh Chodesh. So it's not just the olah, the burnt offering, but the other offerings as well. L'chaper al Yisrael, which atone for Israel. The chol melechet beit Elokeinu, and all of the work that will be done in the house of our God. So we're going to give one-third of a shekel each, and that's going to fund a lot of it. Now, it doesn't really need to fund a lot of it, because the Persians already promised that they're underwriting. But nonetheless, we are going to contribute towards this end. There's something to talk about in terms of the atonement for Israel with these korbanot, whether they're really about atonement or not, but I'm not going there right now. There's too much else that we have to discuss. So let's continue here. We're going to come back to sentence 34. There are things we need to see. I'm not ignoring the sentence. Just read the sentence first, the section first. Sentence 35. V'hagoral, v'hagoralot hipalnu. We also cast lots. Al-Qurban ha'etzim. For the bringing of wood for the temple. Do you remember when we did the census back in chapter 2? And we noted that some of the names that showed up in that census are names that the Talmud lists as families that were responsible for bringing the wood to the temple on an annual basis. So that's from here. It's now telling us that those families cast lots to decide who would bring the wood for the altar. HaKohanim, HaLeviim, VeHa'am, Kohanim, Levites, the nation, everybody takes part in this. Lavi Levet Elokeinu, Levet Avoteinu, Le'itim Mezumanim, Shana B'Shana, to bring to the house of our God, the house of our ancestors, notice the two, right? It's God's house and it's our house. At set times every year, Leva'er al Mizbach Hashem Elokeinu, to burn on the Mizbach of Hashem, our God, Kakatuv Batorah, as is recorded in the Torah, meaning that there should be a fire burning on the altar. So now we're going to fulfill that by bringing the wood. So we'll pause with that for a second. Those three sentences comprise part 5 of the pact. We are going to support the temple with our 1/3 of a shekel. So, here's the big question. Susan, I think this is what you were going to ask. What happened to the half shekel donation?
Yes, that's
funny. Yeah. What happened? How many years have we been learning together already? What happened to the half shekel donation? We had a donation. So now you have to give a 1/3 and a half, but you didn't mention the half here at all.
Wasn't the half all the way removed, like from the bottom?
Top
of the half.
So, but if it's on top of the half, then what you should do is work with your fractions, right, and figure it out, and say that you're now going to bring how many sixths? 5/6, right? It's 5/6. Right? Half plus 1/3 is 5/6. Okay, good. I can do math. Sorry, Debbie, you were going to say?
Well, it says we also instituted, so there's also. Maybe the half is before.
Right, so that's the big question here. What exactly is this? So take a look on your sheet at Ramban in source number 5. This is a comment on the Torah portion of Ki Tisa, which is where we originally had the half shekel show up. And he's commenting on the fact that the opening verses there that describe the donation use the word truma. Actually, that's not Kitisa. Sorry, that's Truma. There's also the business of counting the Jews then, and Nasu Ish Kofar Nasho. But the Torah uses the word Truma 3 times. So he quotes you from the Talmud. Rabotenu Darshumikan Shalosh Trumot. There are 3 Trumot. There are 3 donations, Meri Boya Mikraot, because you have this redundancy in the text of mentioning the word Truma, donation, 3 times, or elevation, 3 times. V'cheinir Ami Mashamar Katuv. And then he quotes you from Divrei Hayamim Bet, Chronicles 2, in which, I think it was King Yoshiyahu said, Madu alo darashta l'halviyim l'avim Yehudam Yerushalayim et mas'at Moshe Eved Hashem v'hakahal Yisrael l'oal ha'idut. He gets upset and he says, why haven't you been collecting the gift that Moshe designated for the temple? That's what King Yoshiyahu says there. From which Ramban deduces, that means the half shekel is going on. The half shekel was not a one-time deal for Moshe that year. It wasn't even limited to the wilderness. The Jews are still supposed to be doing it centuries later. He says, Yerayim Yizeh, Ki Mas'at Moshe Mitzvah L'Dorot. Moshe's gift is in fact across generations. And then he says, V'chein Katuv. And so is recorded in our passage. Ramban believes that what's happening here is simply a fulfillment of the original biblical command. So then why did it go down?
Yeah.
Come 3 times a year.
So that'll be you a full shekel. You only have to do half a shekel. So Ibn Ezra says it's over and above. Source number 6. Nosaf amachsit shekel, added to the half shekel, litzarech en yanim and iskarim, for these purposes. You know, things cost more over time, right? Prices went up, so now there's a surcharge.
An extra membership charge. An extra membership charge to shul.
That's the way it works. Sorry. Now it's a half plus 1/3. Yes. Carbon tax. Very good. Thank you. Yes.
Since the Amiya is ordaining this, It sounds like it's very self-serving.
What do you mean? He's not taking a dime.
People, they have to do this because it's for the benefit of the Levi'im and the Kohanim.
But Nehemiah gets nothing out of it. Nehemiah gets zero out of it. He made that clear already chapters ago, back in chapter 5. He's first of all, he's not a Kohen and he's not a Levi. He's not part of the system. And second, he didn't take. He gave.
He's the one who ordained it.
He ordains the rule, but he's not getting anything out of it. This isn't about him. There's not a dime that goes into Nehemiah's pocket. This is really important. In other words, when you imposing personal cynicism on a text that gives you no basis for it is a problem.
The point is that these taxes are not going to the people. They're only going to the...
But by definition, that means it's going for the people. By definition, that means it's going for... You're not dealing with a nation that views the temple as something outside of themselves. They view the temple as theirs, for their purpose. He even accentuated it by saying, Beit Avotenu. It's not God's house, it's our house.
Isn't it very clear? And also, isn't it very clear? It's an extra charge.
Yeah.
It's a new building.
And that's Ibn Ezra's way of looking at it, is that it is indeed an extra charge. Malcolm offers you another idea.
Oh, yeah, I see.
In source number 7. If you weren't confused by the calendar things, we get one more shot this hour. And this is Malbim. I'm deliberately not going to take you into the sources that he's quoting, because if you want to confuse yourself, you are free. But based on verses in Melachim, the sages have understood that at different times in history, our weights changed. Meaning that different quantities of silver were actually used for a shekel or for a gerah or these different units. He says, Nosava machasit ha-shekel. He says, this is added to the half shekel in Mefarshim, according to some of the commentaries, which we already saw from Ibn Ezra. But then he says, take a look at Malachim Aleph, Kings 1. Sha'az nishtana hamatbeya, that the coin changed. Ushlishit ha-shekel ha-yakimachasit ha-shekel kodem, ha-kodem. He says, the new one-third shekel was what had been historically a half shekel. And he says, go see my commentary in Yechezkel and Ezekiel. I went to see it. And what he's talking about there is Yechezkel changing the weights of coins. It's still very confusing.
It's not like inflation? You're saying it's like...
Well, it may well have been inflation. It may well have been exactly that. What was one half is now... The amount of silver that was one half is now one third. So you're changing the shekel coin to require more silver in a shekel. Is that inflation or deflation?
Yes.
No, each shekel is made up of more silver. Right.
No, it's the same measure of silver to buy the same amount of goods. From day to day.
I'm confused. I'm really confused. Okay. Last point within this. If you take a look at source number 8, it's worth knowing. The idea of the one-third remains. The idea of the one-third does not disappear from Judaism. If you take a look at number 8, Amar Rav Asi says, La'olam al yimna adam atzmo shlishit ha-shekel bashana. A person should not refrain from giving at least a third of a shekel annually. In other words, even if I never meet somebody who is needy, and I don't have a lot of money, every Jew should give at least a third of a shekel, and that's from this idea. So that's the principle here. What we're saying is that either you're going to take these laws as being biblical, in which case the one-third is the one-half, or you're going to take it as rabbinic, and it's one-third on top of one-half. Once again, you could read the pact either way. It can be read along either line. There's more to say about this. Obviously, we did not finish the chapter in the end. God willing, next time, I guess, we will finish the chapter. We're going to do all of chapter 11. You'll see. I'm here. The Beit Midrash is in session until Tisha B'Av, so I don't mind. But I know people have their cottages to go to. That's why I'm trying to finish it. Okay, yeah.